Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. In our last program, we began our panel discussions on 13 Hours, the Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. And the last time we also gave you an overview of what we thought was the core problem that led to this whole horrible tragedy at Benghazi. And today, what we want to do is we're going to let Abraham take the lead, and we want to talk now about the Battle of Benghazi. And I really think that's very appropriate to call it that, because it really was a battle. But it's kind of a remarkable battle, as some of our commenters have been saying in it, that they were really impressed with the bravery of these men. So, Abraham, welcome back to JBL.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
I wouldn't have any other historian here but you, because you're the one that's closest and most available. So I'm just kidding. But Abraham does teach history here at Imperial Academy on the Herbert W. Armstrong campus. And Abraham and I do talk a lot about history, and I consider him more an expert on battles and wars. So let's talk about this battle. And of course, last time we did mention how the military just was not ready for the battle. And I might even read excerpts from an article once we get into it. But maybe you could just start us out and give us a good outline here.
Sure. So I think this should be called the Battle of Benghazi, as you mentioned, because it really was a battle between America and the enemies of America. But there were some exceptional qualities to this battle. And to begin with, just to give a brief overview of some key elements to think about as we go through the narrative of the battle. And the first one, I think, is that the 13-hour story, it really illustrates the best and worst of America. And that's because it really does demonstrate the best in that there are Americans who are still willing to fight for each other. And they still uphold what America represents in the world. And that's really what those GRS operators did. Outnumbered, outgunned, but they still wanted to represent America, and they did fight for their fellow Americans.
One thing that's really interesting to me when we read the book, and even if you look at the articles, is again, give us the number again. There was it six total?
Yes.
Six total GRS operators. And there was 150 radical Islamic terrorists after them. I mean, that to me is that's like the epic battles of history,
right?
You know, where like if you look at you know, of course, Abraham and I, one of our favorite battles of all time is the Battle of Agincourt. You know, when Henry V's forces, I think, where they were outnumbered. What, 5-1?
Yes.
Yeah. And so when you look at, you know, 150 guys after six guys, it is pretty epic. And Abraham and I did see the movie together. We're not recommending the movie. It is really graphic. It is also full of soldier language, and that's also pretty graphic. So we believe in clean language here on JBL. But it is epic, and let's just say we went to see the film in terms of getting ready for these programs. But anyway, go ahead now, Abraham. I just wanted to bring that out. It's 150 radical, emotionally charged Islamists after six very sensible, very disciplined former Navy SEALs, former Marines. You know, so go ahead.
Yeah, that's around 25-1, a little bit more to that, the odds in that battle. So yeah, I think the first thing to notice about these operators is that they weren't soldiers. They were former soldiers, but they weren't wearing the uniform. They were former soldiers, and they still had the warrior code that they learned from the military. But they were private contractors, and they were there. They were getting paid to protect these people, but they were there. They were volunteers. They wanted to be there. They wanted to protect Americans around the world. And I think that's something vital to point out, is that they wanted to be there. That was their job. And they weren't there in uniform. They were there as private contractors. The other thing to notice, this is more of a physical point, is that the battle can be separated into two different sections. The first is the battle at the diplomatic compound, and that's where Ambassador Chris Stevens was when the operators first responded to the initial attack on the diplomatic outpost. The second section, it can be called the battle at the CIA annex, which is where the main battle took place, where the GRS operators and a few other volunteers held off the attackers for several hours as they were trying to just eliminate them. So the other thing to the last thing to notice, I think, from this battle, before we get into the narrative, is that they had no additional support. So each of these men, there are one ex-Army Ranger, two ex-Navy SEALs, and three ex-Marines. In the era of warfare they were all trained in, is when they get overrun, when they need extra support, the U.S. Army would send close air support. They would send them supplies, reinforcements, whatever they needed to get help. That's what their training told them to do. And in their combat experience, they always had that help. That was a guarantee.
But there was no extra help with
exactly.
These two battles. That's the phenomenal part of this whole story, is there was no extra help.
Yeah, exactly. So all these men, they really never experienced anything like this, because they have certain enhancements like night vision goggles. They have a ISR drone, which can help them pick out targets, but that's it. They don't have any heavy weapons. They don't have any close air support when they're outnumbered 30-1. And so I think that's another extraordinary viewpoint of this book, is that most soldiers have never experienced anything like this. The odds to fight shoulder to shoulder with this less than 10 men against being surrounded on all sides, fighting against attackers, and with no air support, no nothing like that. So this experience here, it's, while it does happen, it has happened in the military over the years, obviously in Iraq and Afghanistan. For these six men, this was, I think, a unique experience, because they were really abandoned there, but they still toughed it out and they fought on their own, and they were able to win the day. So I think those are some of the points to think about as we get into this narrative. And the battle began in the diplomatic compound at about 9:43 p.m. So that's when the attack first began, and there was a lot of chanting they could hear in the distance. But contrary to reports, there were no protests about anti-Muslim film, as the State Department would later say. And the attackers, they were not trained soldiers. So they were radical Islamists, but they didn't have any significant training. In a lot of these Islamic countries, most of the armies are made up of young men, unemployed, and in these countries there are an abundance of weapons, either from Russia or Iran, flooding the market. Or in this case, they were able to get a hold of Gaddafi's armories after he fell. So most of the attackers are just young, disgruntled men who hate America and who have an AK-47 or an RPG, which are both easy to use, but they don't really have any battle experience.
I think it's also maybe good to say, if I can just interject something here, is that if you look at, and again, I know that there's this whole discussion in America that you have is Muslim, I guess you have Muslim people that say that Islam is a religion of peace. And then you have, of course, then you have the other side that we know, radical Islam. They don't care if they live or die. And they certainly don't want peace with America. They certainly don't want peace with American ideals. Now, we've said this many times here at Trumpet and with the Philadelphia Trumpet, with the Trumpet.com, even Key of David. I mean, America does have some pretty wretched, immoral lives. And but the thing is that if you look at it from just kind of like an honest point of view, a lot of these radical Islamists don't have a very moral life either. You know, when they went after Muammar Gaddafi, I mean, they sodomized him before they hung him, and that's part of their religion, is so that he, you know, doesn't go off to their view of heaven and all of that. So they have some pretty radical views. And so I do think that when Americans get upset with Islam, they may not say radical Islam, but I think that's what they mean. I don't think, you know, every Islamic person is viewed as a terrorist. And that those are just the way the media just keeps stirring things up. And I certainly don't see, you know, Islamic people. Here we have, I have very close friends that are from Lebanon. I have very close friends, you know, that have Islamic background, and I don't consider them terrorists either. And so I think it, just in terms of talking points, I mean, as we know, we do have a religious background. We do believe in the Bible, and we know that Satan, the devil, and his demon army can highly influence these young men that are very emotionally unstable as well. And so he can fire them up where they'll throw themselves into battle because they don't care if they die or not.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that also brings up why Benghazi is such an anti-American place. And that's a lot of it goes into two things. Usually the first is there's well-established anti-American organizations there, like Al-Qaeda, and Al-Sharia, that claimed responsibility for the attack, and other terrorist groups. They have a lot of experience recruiting young Muslims into their ranks. They're very skilled at it. And it's places like Benghazi where they flourish. Usually combined with that, there's a radical cleric there. So the clerics who teach the people in the mosques, a lot of them aren't radical. But usually a lot of the troubled cities where American troops have had to go fight, like Fallujah in Iraq or Benghazi here, they have ministers, the clerics who are preaching anti-American messages. Yes. And so that's just a breeding ground for this kind of behavior. And so Benghazi's always been known as kind of a hard town where a lot of maybe the undesirables of the country go. And so that's a great place for anti-American terrorist groups to really get their recruits from.
Yes, and I think another just small part of it, I don't want to keep interrupting you here, but if you look at it, America did at one time support Muammar Gaddafi. And, you know, he was in Tripoli, and the people in Tripoli lived well. They lived well off of oil. They lived well off the wealth. You know, they had this, very wealthy society. But the Benghazians, as you said, were almost like the untouchables of India. They did not have the wealth. They were cut out of the wealth. And there was always this tension. And even they bring it out in the book, you know, about how even over soccer games that they would control the soccer games so Benghazi lost, so the Tripoli always looked good. You know, so there was a lot of anti-American feeling, even because just the way at one point, you know, America did support Gaddafi. And, so that was a problem that just added fuel to their anger. So...
Yeah, that's also very true, where a lot of the neglect or policies of even America trying to help Libya ended up fueling the fire there.
Like there's no democracy in Libya right now, you know, and this is what it was all about. And I think right now we don't even have a Libyan embassy anymore, do we?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I think that ended in like that whole idea ended in like 2014. So anybody, if this is a good comment, if anybody out there knows we're wrong, you can write a comment in. I'm after comments today. So go ahead.
Comment.
Go ahead, Abraham.
So they get into the battle now. At 9:43, that's when the first attack began on the diplomatic outpost. The DS agents, so the State Department agents who are tasked with the protection of Chris Stevens, they're relaxing or finishing up paperwork, not expecting anything in particular. But all of a sudden, shots ring out. There's a couple RPGs are fired into the compound. And so all of a sudden, they have to scramble to try to get into a proper defensible position to find the ambassador and get him into a safe place. And on top of that, all their safeguards fail. So the 17th February martyrs, who are the allied militia, they all run away from the main gate or are killed in the first few minutes. And then the Libyan security, which work with a British security firm there, all the guards run as well.
Yeah, which is what happened in 1967.
Right, yeah, exactly. So they all run from the main gate. And so in the first 2 minutes of the battle, the attackers have complete control of the diplomatic compound. They have control of the main gate. They can come and go as they please. They can feed in any number of reinforcements that they want. And so right at the outset, the DS agents are thrown on the defensive, and they're separated into three different groups, so they can't really effectively do much of anything. And so between 9:43 and about 10 o'clock, so about for 20 minutes, this attack goes on. And in the meantime, this is when they burn a few buildings on the grounds. That's when Ambassador Stevens is locked in the safe haven and where the building is lit on fire with the diesel cans. And during this time, Scott Wilkland and others are calling people for help, calling the GSR operators, calling the State Department for help. And it's in these 20 minutes that the GRS operators at the annex, so that's only a mile away, so they can hear the gunshots, they can see the RPG explosions. They jock up, that's what they call, putting on all their battle armor, their weapons, getting them loaded, ready to go. And just a few minutes, they're ready to go, and they're waiting to leave. And it's in those 20 minutes, this is, I think, the most important part of the battle. In those first 20 minutes where this attack is going on, it's in that time frame that the GRS operators are told to stand down two or three times by Bob, the base chief.
By Bob, yes.
So it's in that time that a lot of the operators, and I'll read that in the quote later, where they think that if they left right away, right at around 9:50, when they were ready to leave, if they left right away, they would have been able to save Chris Stevens' life and Sean Smith, the IT guy over there, and everyone else. Before the diesel fuel, before the building was lit on fire, before the attackers could really do whatever they wanted, if they were able to leave as soon as they found out and go there, they could have saved their lives. And so that's the critical time period. Also in this time period, you have the State Department notifying President Obama about what's going on, and you have General Hamm in Germany starting to mobilize the different assets, trying to get some kind of response or look at when they can get there. So it's in those 20 minutes you have the GRS operators waiting that you really see, I think, the character and the clash between the CIA way of thinking and the warrior way of thinking. The CIA, they're intelligence gatherers. They're not combatants. They're not trained for combat. They're meant to be there covertly, not to gain attention to themselves. And so you have a clash of interest where the base chief doesn't want to expose the annex or leave it unprotected. And the GRS operators want, their first instinct is to go and save the American lives because they're only a mile away. They know they can get there. They're highly trained. I mean, they're all Marines, Rangers, or Navy SEALs. Those are all among the elite in the U.S. Army. So they're all very highly trained. And
That is one point I think that maybe may not be so clear in the book, but you really have to read it maybe several times to get it, is that Bob, and it's not his real name, by the way, he's still being protected because he is a spy, But Bob was really trying to protect CIA interests at the time. He wasn't necessarily as interested in protecting the diplomatic corps. And so that's that is I think a very important point to point out. So
yeah, that's a great point. And I think that decision would come back to haunt him, because when he was testifying before Congress, he said he never gave an order to stand down. When two men, Tonto and Tig, they both say that the base chief looked them in the eye and told them to stand down. So there's a conflict of what happened there. But the operators are, I think it's pretty safe to say that if they were not told to leave, they would have been gone a long time ago. As soon as they could have left. And so in that 20 minutes, they're getting ready until eventually they hear one call on the radio where they hear the pleading in the voice, the desperation, and they say, if you don't get over here, we're all going to die.
Yes.
And so that's when they decide just to leave against orders. And at this point, just maybe a quick mention on the chain of command here. So you have Bob, the base chief. He's in charge of all the operations. And then in the book, you have someone called TL, or the team leader. His name is also confidential. But he was a CIA staffer in charge of the GRS operators. So he was the main one in charge of the military assets. And he goes with the operators to the compound now in two different vehicles.
But he is still a CIA operative. He's not like a former Navy SEAL. He's not a normal combatant.
Correct.
In the army, so
yeah.
or in an armed conflict, so that's, I think that's very important to point out, and I think that does lead to some of the confusion of what happened there.
Yeah, exactly. And so now that they're actually on the way, they encounter some roadblocks in their two vehicles once they leave the compound, and they have to move on foot in two groups. Tyrone Woods takes one group towards the main gate. And Tonto takes another group to provide sniper overwatch. But there aren't really any good places, so he moves around to the back of the compound to go to the back gate. And I think there's this one passage here. It's from page 118 of my version of the book. And it recounts when Tyrone Woods first runs into the compound. And I think it really epitomizes the spirit of all the operators, just the bravery involved here. So when they... when they get there, they're just at the front gate waiting to get in. But all of a sudden, Roan just leaps ahead and starts sprinting into the compound without even telling anyone where they're going. So Tig, he's with Roan and Jack, who are the first group. He calls on the radio that we're moving into the compound. And then here's the quote from the book. Roan took Tig's radio call as a signal. Without warning his companions, he sprang to his feet and quick-stepped around the concrete barrier. Roan rounded the corner of low hedges and ran headlong through the gate into the compound, his assault rifle pointing the way forward. Jack had expected that they'd make eye contact or otherwise communicate before moving, but when he saw Roan move, his training kicked into gear. A bedrock rule among SEALs and other special operators is that no one goes in alone, ever, regardless of whether they're entering a room or in an open space. Roan had been trained the same way, so Jack knew that when he led the charge, Roan felt confident that Jack and Tig would have his back. And so Roan, they're just at the precipice there, and he just runs it right in, leading the charge. He doesn't know what's in there. He doesn't know if there are enemies waiting to mow him down or not. He just runs straight in there. And I think that just epitomizes the kind of men that they were, that they weren't afraid to risk their lives for the CIA staffers, for Chris Stevens. And they were trying to get there as fast as possible because they knew disaster could possibly await them.
Yeah, it is, I think it's really remarkable. But I do think it really points out what we were saying before, that when you have two different types of thinking, like you have the CIA operatives thinking one way, but you have trained soldiers thinking in a combat way, and then if the combat aren't in the head of the chain of command, then you're going to have problems. And so that's exactly what they experienced there, and it led to some real disastrous results.
Yeah, exactly. And I think each of these men did their best to uphold the warrior culture in America, the one that America trains its soldiers to uphold: dignity, honor, bravery, duty. They each did their best to uphold that standard. And they, especially in this situation where they went in to go save these men. And so when both groups arrive there, there isn't really any attackers. Most of them have left to regroup. So they're able to go look for the ambassador. In the meantime, they do find Sean Smith's body. He dies from smoke inhalation. And that's diesel fumes, so it's a mixture of poison. It's not just normal smoke. But they're unable to find Ambassador Chris Stevens' body. So they meet a counterattack from the extremists, and then they're able to exfil from the diplomatic compound back to the CIA annex.
Well, I think we're going to have to say we're out of time for today, but we're going to continue this on our next program. So if you have any comments that you would like to write to me, you can do that at jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook, and that address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.